lo and behold, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is upon us. It's been a little while, folks, but it's going to be worth the wait. We're going to be featuring a lot of convivial conversations with various musical potentates, most of which you've heard of. Some are going to be some new discoveries. That's why I'm here, to bring forth the chewable gristle matter to you via the information superhighway. Brought to you, of course, by our friends at Wildwood Guitars in beautiful Louisville, Colorado, and our friends at Fishman Transducers of beautiful Andover, Massachusetts. Both I've had great long-standing relationships with and continue to do so, and we're very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor of giving you the highest quality and chewable gristle possible. Now, without any further ado, folks, let's get down and dirty with some Chewing the Gristle Season 5. Buckle up. This week on Chewing the Gristle, we have the mighty Davy Knowles, blues rock sensation, vocalist and guitar player extraordinaire, hailing originally from the Isle of Man in the UK, now a resident of the Chicagoland area. Just a joy to talk to, and he's an outstanding musician and cat. This week, Davy Knowles is chewing the damn gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, once again we gather around the gristle campfire for a little Chewing the Gristle sesh. Gregory Cawk here with the mighty Davy Knowles, guitar player, vocalist, songwriter extraordinaire, hailing originally from the Isle of Man. Some people think he is the illegitimate offspring of one Happy Jack, but I don't know if that is true or not. Perhaps we will find out right now. Davy, how's it going? What's happening?
I am all right. How are you?
I cannot complain. I am back in the warm bosom of my hometown for a week before I go back out again. Now, where are you as we speak?
I am just behind the cheddar curtain from you. I am in Chicago.
You know, I was wondering if you still lived in Chicago, because I knew you were last time we had spoken. I think there's spokes involved. But so you've been in Chi-Town land for a while now.
Long time, yeah. Gosh, 14, 15 years, I would have thought at this point.
And yeah. Whereabouts do you live down there in the great metropolitan area?
Northwest side.
Aha. Uh-huh. So not too far away from the Cheddar Curtain itself.
Not at all. Just a hop, skip, and a jump. Yeah.
Yeah, so when you need some Kringle, or if you need to escape in the time of the great apocalypse, you can come up to the great North Woods of Wisconsin, and we'll just let the good times roll.
There's that, what's it called, the Mars Cheese Castle?
Yes.
I didn't know cheese needed a whole castle, but there's one right there.
Well, you know what? It is such a tasty product that it needs a fortress to protect the great quantity of hole-infested milk products that... I don't even know what that means. I guess that's speaking of Swiss cheese of a nature, but be that as it means. So what's been the latest? What's been happening? I see you've been going out and doing some acoustic stuff.
Yeah. I came out with an acoustic album last year, and I went out and started playing a whole bunch of, well, a few tours really of acoustic music, which is been amazing for me. I've really enjoyed it. It's something I kind of grew up listening to and never really had the chance to go out and do. So it feels good. Yeah.
Well, I've seen some clips and it sounds fabulous.
You're kind. Thank you very much. It's been fun.
I dig it. And, you know, the acoustic thing is something as well. There's just something satisfying about being able to sit by yourself and perform and have it sound, you know what I mean, all inclusive, not missing.
Yeah, sure. Fallen. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of, my dad was a big folky, kind of English folk. People like Bert Jansch.
Oh yes,
and John Rembore. Davy Graham, and that whole kind of Pentangle folk scene. John Martin as well. So I grew up listening to all of that stuff and idolizing it and. Kind of, it's been quietly bubbling away for a long time for me. So yeah, it's been great, very satisfying. Like you say, to go out there and just kind of do a whole thing on that. Yeah.
The whole kind of English take on the folk stuff is always so interesting because, you know, I went into a deep dive with the Davy Graham stuff years ago. You know, primarily because of, like, well, where did White Summer actually come from? Well, it was, it was a David Graham thing, right? And then Burt Jansch was the same thing. And but also Richard Thompson and guys like that. And there's just such an interesting convergence of Americana with that kind of English folk song thing.
Yeah.
It's just so satisfying, as they say.
It is. It's lovely. It is. It's interesting to say that because a lot of the kind of impression of English folk is it's kind of very, I don't know, long and rambling and this kind of quite like the English, really. It's our fault. But but there is this amazing injection of that kind of early 60s, a lot of Mississippi John Hurt and a lot of Reverend Gary Davis and these kinds of country blues is a
Big
huge...
Bill Broomsey.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, all of that stuff. So, yeah, there is this kind of transatlantic thing, for sure.
And then also, you know, especially like with old Davy Graham, he had that, you know, the more exotic, more of the world music thing that I think was brand spanking at that particular time.
Yeah, kind of king of the dadgad, really, wasn't he? And he had this very, I think he spent time in Morocco, in North Africa.
I think he did, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of Arabic sounding elements to what he's doing. It's amazing.
Absolutely, and again, it's going back to that thing of one guy just sitting down and letting that whole melting pot of all those different influences just spontaneously come out. And because when you're solo, as you well know, you can do whatever the hell you want.
There's space, there's time, all of the things. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, fabulous.
But it's not for the meek, though, right? I mean, at first, you know, the first time I did a couple of solo things, it's like, yeah, I got no one else here.
Yeah, you feel pretty exposed at that. Like, I'd like to thank my band, you know?
Right, exactly.
It is terrifying, but it's also, I found it a really good opportunity. Sometimes with the band thing, you're so focused on kind of bam, 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 let's go, you know, big fire, you know, you forget... the kind of context of everything and the acoustic idea, you know, the idea with the acoustic thing is to be able to say, well, this is why this song came about. This is how this song came about. And the opportunity to kind of give a bit of context to what you do is a really lovely thing, I think, a bit of a breath.
Right. And I think to that point, I mean, there's a lot of sense to the fact of if you can make a song sound full and complete and have it be effective just in a solo environment, chances are it's a good one, and that in a full band context, it's going to even be better.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. It's going to work.
I like, I always kind of make the joke about the Robert Johnson stuff. Cause you know, I think as people who, you know, I grew up listening to Cream records and, you know, and Hendrix. And then I went back and listened to, you know, BB King and Albert King and, you know, I was a big Muddy Waters fan and so on and so forth. But of course I kept on seeing, you know, Clapton and the Stones and everyone who I was really into would reference Robert Johnson. I was like, well, I got to hear this shit, you know, especially when, you know, it's like, oh, he sold his soul to the devil for prodigious talent.
Yeah, right.
And then the first time you put that record on, when you're used to listening to, you know, contemporary recordings and you hear this, and you hear this guy going, hello, my baby. You're like, this guy sold his soul for this? I mean, what's... This seems like kind of a bad deal. And then when you really kind of take the deep dive and allow yourself to be in, you know, be in that space where you're just kind of giving into the whole thing, then it's a thing of wonder because you really come to the realization that everything he's doing syncopation-wise, accompanying himself and so on, was really the blueprint for what would be the contemporary blues band and certainly rock and roll band. I mean, you can hear it all going on. And that's a fascinating thing. And I think it's important to kind of do that deep dive, even though, as I said, I think it becomes harder. And I always make this reference too to people is that, you know, with each subsequent generation who gets exposed to this roots music, you know, just because of, unless you have a parent or an older sibling or something like that. And if you just stumble upon it, obviously who's ever the current, you know, du jour, blues person or whoever that initially gets you the gateway drug, if you will, you're used to that contemporary sound. You're used to that both on recording and live. And then when you start listening, well, what about this Hendrix guy? Or what about this Albert King? And the farther you go back, a lot of times they can't make the connection of, well, yeah, that's actually verbatim shit from these other guys, because they can't get past the production value. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And it's kind of the wonderful thing about any folk music is the constant progression of it. And I think that there is always the room and the importance of the preserve and protect brigade, where it's, you know, we have to play this exactly like Albert King did it. We have to do that. But ultimately, how any of this music survives is the progression of it. But I think it's also, like you're saying, it's so important to understand the context of when that music was made, how it was made, the limitations that were in place, and from a recording aspect, production aspect, all of this. And understand the context of it. But it's hard. The accessibility of it is different, isn't it? It's interesting. My first kind of gateway, like you're saying, the first host, if you like, was John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, was the Beano album. And if you look at that record, like the first track is an Otis Rush song, then there's a Freddie King song, and then there's a Ray Charles song, there's a Robert Johnson song. You know, it's got so many of the major players. You read the liner notes and you go, I have to get all of this stuff. And it is shocking to go back and go, well, I think I like Eric Clapton's playing a bit
exactly,
more.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. And that's just and human it, nature, right?
It is, of course it is. But preference is a beautiful thing and opinion is a wonderful thing. But then you, further to that, you know, the internet, which is such a bastion of all things true and knowledgeable, you know?
Lord have mercy.
You see so many comments. Whenever there's a picture of Eric Clapton, he's become this very polarizing figure, I feel like. You know, so many people comment, oh, he's boring, all of this stuff. And I'm going, good Lord, if you listen to what happened between 66, which is when the Beano album came out, or even before that with the Yardbirds. And you listen to what, 1971, which was Derek and the Dominoes? Is that right? Or 72, around
that? Well, by 70, I think, I think by late, I'm sorry, I'm geeking out here, but by late 71, I think he was already kind of ensconced in his heroin hideaway.
Absolutely, but if you look at the difference of the music and the development of what's gone on in any direction, how many different things the guy wrote the book on at that point. And I'm going, you're missing the point. You might be bored to tears with his version of Over the Rainbow. That's absolutely fine. You're entitled to your opinion. But don't discount everything the man did.
Well, exactly. No, to that exact point, I mean, imagine, God forbid, that Clapton would have succumbed to his drug addiction in 1971. He'd be held in the same regard as Hendrix. This guy was around for the look at the shit this guy done. No one did it, but listen to music before him and then listen to music after. And that's the other thing that drives me crazy is when, you know, because people are always, there's always got to be this element of competition and, you know, who is underrated?
Yeah,
God, I hate that word. I hate the word underrated. It's just like, listen, there's simply people you appreciate because you've heard it and there's people that you don't. But you know what? It's not, there's no like grand sorcerer keeping score of this shit.
Absolutely.
But when people talk about, oh, well, Peter Green was really better than Clapton, you're just like, first of all, there is no better. But there, let's just be clear. There would have been no Peter Green if it wasn't for Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely what people don't understand. It's like, first of all, the Les Paul into the Marshall, Eric Clapton, the end. That sound, that whole attitude, which Peter Green was the first to say, the whole reason why I did that was because of Eric Clapton. You know, and then of course he developed into his own thing and did everything.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Which I loved as well. But I mean, I don't know why people have to, you know, and then of course they get, as you said, they get, you know, jaded by their personal opinions of him and his opinions on various different things and so on and so forth. And then, you know, now it's almost become something where online, especially if you go on, you know, Twitter or X or whatever it's called now, and then the new one Threads, you know, where these people, you know, offer their piping hot opinions on this, that, the next thing, which I do not engage in. I mean, I engage musical stuff on in a humorous thing every now and again. I don't engage in opinion slang, you know, with other, and that, you know,
That's just my thing. I don't judge others. Of course I do, but be that as it may. but how people just, you know, they pile drive on Clapton, and you're just like, okay, well, first of all, you got to separate whatever your opinion about whoever it is. You got to separate the person from the art.
Of course, because
you know, most of the time, if we met a lot of our idols, which I've had some great experiences, and other times I'm just like, oh my God, this guy's a dick with ears, you know. But you know, you got to separate the, you know, the music from the person, and it's just, I think it's become fashionable now to just pile drive on Clapton, and it's just like, first of all, yeah, I mean, to your point as well. I mean, there was something that happened in those early years where his artistic arc was guitar first, and the guitar was the song, and his vocals were a framework for his guitar playing. And then after that, it became more about the song and the voice, and the guitar was, it just kind of stayed where it was at. And
I happen to love all of it equally. Exactly. I think to be able to do that, I think it's brave, you know, to go and follow artistically what you want to do, despite what people might expect of you. And B, I think it speaks to his versatility as an artist, you know.
Right.
Being able to do that, from one hand, go and do All Your Love or Stepping Out or something like that, to Wonderful Tonight. I think that's absolutely spectacular.
I agree. My only, you know, and again, this is just because I'm a fan, but again, people can do whatever they want as artists, and that's the way it is, and we should all respect that. But for me, it's like, yeah, you can go in all these different directions. It doesn't mean you have to completely not do that other thing, though. You know what I mean?
That's true too. Yeah, that's true too.
And so, that's being nitpicky. Again, when you look at the expanse of the career and everything that was done, I mean, it's, you know, some reverence at the very least is in order.
Absolutely. Agreed entirely.
But on another subject, let's talk about, I mean, you've done all kinds of different things, but in the recent years, you, I think going back to 2017, you did the thing with Jerry McAvoy and the drummer McKenna, right?
McKenna, yeah.
And doing talk about a little bit about the Rory Gallagher affiliation and his influence on you originally and what it meant to be a part of that thing.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I grew up on the Isle of Man, which is a Celtic nation. It's only about 40 miles off the coast of Ireland. I could see on a clear day the mountains of Mourne in Northern Ireland from the house I grew up in. You know, it's right there. And so I grew up around a lot of folk music, a lot of Irish sounding folk music. Manx folk music has got a lot in common with it. You know, at the same time, I was heavy into this great big, you know, electric guitar thing. I started playing because of Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits and then, you know, early Clapton with, you know, all of this stuff. So very American sounding things. When I heard Rory for the first time, it blew me away. And I would have been about 13 maybe, because to me, it sounded like, here is a guy who is playing all of this very aggressive American influenced music. But with this lilt to his playing that sounded so familiar to me, that it was almost like a jig or a reel in his phrasing. I don't know if you can really hear this, but it was, you know, instead of you know, it'd be
exactly, yep,
those kinds of things, right? And to me, that was, I don't know, that blew me away. I'd never heard that before. And I loved his lack of, I don't know, and there wasn't a hint of pretentiousness about it. It was just go out, go to work, and I loved that. I've been a huge fan, and then it was about 2017-ish, I got a message from Jerry, who was his bass player for 20-odd years, you know, did every album, and I saw you do something on Facebook, you know, to celebrate his birthday, you want to do something. It was, oh my God. And that turned into a lot of tours with Jerry and Ted, who was Rory's drummer in the kind of late 70s, mid to late 70s. And And he was with the sensational Alex Harvey band well. Great band. And sadly, we lost Ted a few years ago. And but we, Brendan O'Neill, who was Rory's last drummer for the last kind of 10 years of his life. So we've been going out and doing stuff too. And it's just this amazing moment of, you know, you become friends with your heroes and then you are on stage and you look around and you go, shit, how did this happen? This is amazing, you know? And also thinking, don't fuck up. But it's it's absolutely wonderful. They're amazing, absolutely amazing, and it's just been an education and a joy.
Well, what's interesting is I got into Rory kind of late in the game, just because you have your initial influences, and then you go on, and I mean, most of the stuff I got into initially was all because of my brother's record collection, and then everything else kind of fanned out from there, and somehow the threads of whatever I was into didn't lead to Rory. And so to me, there were all these kind of, blues rock kind of outlier guys that I was like, okay, well, that's that. But I've already gone back to the real shit. So I don't need to check these guys out. You know what I mean? And then I would hear stuff and I was like, yeah, that's cool. But I was already kind of, just because we are how we are. Isn't it weird how you have to hear things in the right context and you're like, oh yeah, there it is. I get it. You know what I mean? And for me with Rory, it was, we were playing in Germany somewhere. It wasn't all that long ago. I want to say it was maybe 10 years ago. And again, I'd heard various different Rory things. I even think we did a tune of his on, I did this Australian thing with the Fender guys and there was the new Rory Strat out. So we learned a Rory tune and I think I referenced something on this Strat book that I was a part of doing like little sound bites for. And I listened to a Rory thing real quick and did kind of a slide thing. So I was aware of it, but I never did any kind of deep dive. You know what I mean? And these two Irish guys came over to this gig that I was doing in Germany. Like, when are you going to play in Ireland? I was like, well, we don't have an agent there yet. So it's been kind of hard, yada, yada, yada. They're like, well, we're big fans. And he goes, we're also big fans of Rory Gallagher and we wanted to give you this. And so it was just a copy. It was a CD of the 74 Irish tour.
Oh, yeah.
And that was it. I listened to that thing and I've been a fan ever since. Just because, as you said, everything you stated, just the non-pretense, straight in, let the good times roll. But I dug his tunes. And again, that there's that, again, with the blues, there's that Celtic underpinning, both in the songs and in the playing. And plus, there's a weird connectivity to me, almost in the time that he kind of, became more popular, and like his first record cover was very similar to Roy Buchanan's first record. There's a connection between those two. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know how much of that was actually, it was just serendipitous, or if there was like, the record company going, hey, Rory Gallagher's out. This guy's kind of an American similarity. You know what I mean? I don't know if you ever felt that way.
I feel like there's a lot of parallels between Rory and Roy Buchanan. Absolutely. Yeah, and again, this kind of I don't know. They felt like guitar players in a way. They weren't like the shiny pop stars. There was a grit about both of them, which was, I don't know, mysterious. I think to a degree.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Just the absolute devotion people have to Rory. I mean, there's just It is definitely
rabid. Yeah,
there you go. That's the word I was looking
for. Yeah, and especially in Northern Europe too. You find it. That was his real kind of stomping ground.
And it's interesting when you watch those videos that are on like Ona Filter or
Rock Palace.
What's Rock Palace? There you go. And how he just comes out and he just is like, I am going to scald your brain.
Absolutely. Yeah, good luck with this. I also it was something about the gear he used I loved too. No, it was just, it wasn't like a bunch of effects. It was a Strat, an AC30, sometimes like the old Fender Twin, the Tweed Twin. And it was just like plug in. And it doesn't, I don't know, it was like this idea of it doesn't really matter. It's not about that.
And Roy was the same way. Roy was like straight in, except later on, he's like, I think I'll use a little delay pedal as well.
and that really flushed the boat out. Yeah. So hold you sound for me.
So talk a little bit about what you're doing these days. And you know, you've been, I mean, you're a young lad, but you've been at it for a while now, touring and so on and so forth. And I was listening to a concert you did at the Funky Biscuit, where we're going to be down in a couple of weeks, actually. And they're always good about recording the shows there and putting it out to the great unwashed. But yeah, it was great. It was rocking. And so talk a little bit about what you how much of your year you spend on the road and what other stuff you do to, as we know, to make ends meet as a musician is not for the meek.
Certainly not. No. These days I'm actually a dad of three. I have three little girls. So
you do? How old are these rascals?
5, 2, and coming up on 6 months.
Oh, bless you.
So you can actually visibly see the gray hairs just sprouting. You can watch them grow. It's amazing. But I try to be really sensible in my kind of touring schedule. I like the kind of 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off kind of thing is about what I like to do.
And that's about, yeah, that is sanity maintaining.
I think so, yeah. Well, ultimately, I also, you know, in the kind of, in my younger days, you know, when I first started this.
What, when you were 12?
Yeah. Which is only a couple of years ago now. We were 19, 20 when we first came to the States, and it was, it was like 200 odd dates a year. I mean, it was absolute madness, really. And I could cope with it back then, and it was fine. But it didn't take too long for me to realize if I want to do this for the rest of my life, then I've got to pace myself accordingly. You know, it is an uncomfortable living sometimes. And so you strike that balance between maintaining health and safety regs and making a living, right? And you try and do that. So it's about striking a balance there. And then along with this acoustic thing, we're just getting ready to record a new band album. We just got off a few shows, kind of trying all that stuff out, whipping the band into shape myself. So we're just about to go and do that. And then really it's kind of that whole thing of write record tour,
yes,
it's a wonderful thing. I love it. It's kind of it's nice to get into that pattern of things. It's fun.
Absolutely. The youngins. Yeah, I've got four of those rascals. Of course, now my youngest is in college now, so he's a sophomore in college. So, and of course my oldest plays in the band with me. So
I see that. Yeah, amazing. What a feeling that must be.
It's pretty wild. I mean, it is, you know, we get along great and he plays great, and it's just wild. And to have people come up at the end of the night and say, you know, man, your kid, you know, cause it, you know, I think the supposition is that it's nepotism. And I'm like, listen, he found the organ player, you know, and I go, and if I wasn't here, you'd be saying he's a great drummer, whether I'm here or not. So, but he, you know, he more than excels on his own. So it's been a lot of fun. I've always been, I don't know if you're the same way, but to me, it's always been, I've always attempted to have the same, I've always wanted just a band, because a band, the longer they play together, it becomes this thing that cannot be replicated. And now you can always do something where, you know, you can hire hot shots. You know what I mean? You can, you know, guys that are the super session guys, or, you know, that you always see playing with other people. And that's going to be at a level of excellence regardless, because they're that good of players. But does it become this congealed other thing that can't be replicated? No.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I totally agree.
And so as a result of doing this thing with my son and with Toby and just beating it on the year, it's this beast, right? And I think as me being a fan of various bands over the year, whether it be, you know, Zeppelin or the Meters or whoever, you know, you just love, even when good times, bad times, you just love the fact that exists, because you know they're going to create something from that initial embryonic state that's just become this thing that you're not going to hear anywhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's fun for me.
I've done the kind of the hired gun thing, and like you say, I mean the musicianship is astounding, but also there's this kind of underlying feeling of no one in the room believes in your project as much as you do. You
absolutely.
Know? And so, you know, so there is a degree of this is a paycheck for them, kind of a commercial transaction.
Totally.
And they might be the sweetest people in the world, but there is that underlying thing there.
Whereas they're always scoping for another gig, you know, they're always there's always this level of sycophancy, and I just, you know what I mean. It's you'd rather just have guys one for all. We're all in it together. You don't have to worry about me replacing your ass unless you do something, you know,
ridiculous,
catastrophic.
absolutely. And you know, it's really hard to find. And so when you do find that, you hang on tight to it, and it's a wonderful, beautiful thing.
And what's hard about it is, like, to me, it's like if you can find one other person in the band, let alone two, but more than that, it's like really hard.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because musicians in general are, present company excluded, of course, are, you know, it's just, man, you never know. Well, plus the other thing is, too, it's like I gave up partying years and years ago, you know, like it's 30 years now, right? So, I have no tolerance for it. I mean, I'm not judgmental. As long as you get your shit done, I don't care. But I got, you know, my son doesn't do anything. He doesn't use anything. And Toby, like, will have a beer. And that is so liberating because you don't have to worry about, because I remember back in the day, you know, and I still see it with other things I might be involved in where I'll guest star with somebody or play or sit in with somebody. And, you know, people are at the bar and they're staying until like 3 a.m. And it's like, oh, what time's the bus call, hotel, the lobby call? You know, and then you got to deal with, they're hungover and all that. I mean, I get it. But at the same token, I don't want it around me.
Totally. The three of us, none of us drink. It's amazing. It's absolutely astounding. And, I'll tell you a funny story. We were up in Minneapolis years ago, and we got there loading time, you know, 4 p.m. and the opening band already there. It's a little club, and they'd already set up on this tiny stage, you know, the size of my desk here, you know, a wall of Marshall full stacks and like the double bass drum Ginger Baker kind of thing. And I remember that the name on the heads of the drums was Cocaine was the name of the band. Which I thought this is going great. And they were there in like 80s era Guns N' Roses leather with the bottle of Jim Beam and, you know, the cowboy boots crossed up on the table. You know, it was absolutely hilarious. And we were kind of walking in. Two things happened that night. You know, there's, our fan base tend to be kind of middle-aged white guys, really. That's how it tends to be. We're playing this club, and it's half full at this point, and they're on stage, and the singer's got his shirt off, and he's got his foot on the monitor, and I remember him going, "You guys better watch your girls because they've been looking at me since I got on stage." And from the back of the room, I shit you not, from the back of the room, all you hear was, "Fuck you, man." And we absolutely fell about. Now, after the show, the guy comes up to the singer, comes up to us. He says, "Hey, man, you guys sounded really good." Like, likewise, thank you very much. And he said, you know, we're going out afterwards. You know, we have a few drinks. You know, we got a bit of this, you know, bit of this. And I just remember the drummer going, "And I've got a good book." And off we went. It was just, oh my God, you know, horrific, just horrific. So yeah, I'm all for slippers on, cup of tea in an early night.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle-infested conversation to give a special shout-out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kauk signature Fluence Gristle Tone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat. in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains.
What's been interesting is that, you know, for years, I put together this career in the States where, you know, I always had my bands and I'd put out CDs, but we never had a decent booking agent. So, you know, we'd have like, you know, little anchor gigs here and there, and we'd put a couple things around it. But most of like the tours I would do were in Europe, you know, where it'd be, you know, go out for a couple, 3 weeks or whatever, sometimes a month, whatever the case may be. But that, the only time I had any kind of real like agent venue tour bus, tour vehicle, I should say. I'm not going to give you any delusions that we had any kind of bus other than a Sprinter, but be that as it may. But now that we're, you know, set just like right before COVID, we got this great booking agent. And then of course COVID happened, which was unfortunate. We had this ability to do all these live streams from the house, which a lot of people tuned into, which was better because when we went out, I mean, COVID wasn't great for anybody by any stretch, but it was at least advantageous for us when we went out and started just hitting the road and doing clubs. People were showing up going, hey, you know, we've been watching you online and da da da. So that's led to this whole thing where we've been able to go out and make dough. But what's great about it is I tell people, you know, because I think most local musicians in general, you know, they're used to like, you know, you don't go on until 10 o'clock at night. They want you to play until, or you go on at 9 or 10 and you got to play until 2 in the morning. You get paid shit money and, you know, multiple sets. And at the end of the night, you're loading your stuff out and it's all about, you know, the party and the hang. And I get all that because I did it for, you know, my whole youth, my 20s. I don't remember because it was just, it was that, you know?
Yeah.
But now to your point, I mean, when you're playing at these showcase clubs, where it's a music club, it's not like a club like, oh, look, there's a band here. You know what I mean? It's specifically for music, and people show up. You're on at like 8, and you do an hour and a half set, maybe with encores. You play two hours, sell your merch, you hang out with folks for a little bit, you pack up your shit. You're back at the Hampton Inn 10:30, 11 at the latest. Maybe I'll work out in this delicious workout center here at the Hampton Inn and wake up for that sumptuous breakfast with mystery meats and fake eggs.
You know, I've never had that overwhelming desire to hit the gym, but I know what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, it's civilized, isn't it? And I also think from an audience standpoint, I mean, they're different kinds of gigs, right? The whole play the 4 a.m. bar, you know, three sets of an hour, you know, all these kinds of things. It's for a different kind of thing. There's a revolving door of, you know, clientele that come in but with your own ticketed shows and all of that stuff, putting on, you know, 2 hours of a show for people. I mean, if you played all night, you'd hurt their ears. There is a degree of, this is best for everyone. If this is not an all-night event, come in nice and early. You know, it's very civilized. I think it's a nice way of doing things.
And you, to your point about the openers, it's like I tell people, hey, we got an opener. I'm like, nope. And the thing is I don't care if it's like an acoustic duo or something like that. But the whole thing is that we are a lot to take in. We're loud as fuck. And, you know, and we there's times where it's just balls to the wall and we like to, but we, you know, we play dynamically and all that kind of stuff, but it's a lot to take in. So if we, you know, and of course, being a guitar player, some guitar player guy wants to open up for you. And of course, rightly so, they want to do their thing. They want to let their freak flag fly. But a lot of times it's like no good deed goes unpunished. They go up. They play too long. They're loud as shit. And by the time you get on, the crowd is already like, you know, especially, you know, some of the people that were dragged along to the show that maybe were unwilling supplicants. and they're like, Jesus wept. Now I got to hear these guys. You know what I mean? So I'm always like, I'm very nice. And I go, listen, when they start reaching out or somebody like the band itself will reach out, I'm like, listen, I totally get it. When I was younger, I always wanted to open up for all these people. And I did. I was able to open up for a bunch of people at this club in town that always wanted openers. So it was like they would reach out to me to do it. But I'm always like, listen, I appreciate you, the fact that you want to do this, but it's just too much. It's just, you know, plus, you know, we have a B, these stages are small and we got, you know, Toby's B3 and his bass rig and the Leslie and all of a sudden, oh yeah, let's all set up and get a sound check and then move our shit back. so
yeah,
that,
not really,
you
know, very
prim- Mitch McCorkendale and the All Night Pounders can come up and throttle Voodoo Child for 30 minutes. You know what I mean? It's like, who's winning here? No one.
It's true. It's true. There is this also kind of habit of promoters to be like, oh, you guys like a blues rock band? That's cool. Let's put another two blues rock bands on the bill.
Right.
And by the time it comes to you, like you say, the audience is totally worn out on the thing. I think it's great to have, you know, a little community with this stuff. There's, you know, maybe a kid who's kind of maybe like a local hero, up and coming, fabulous, brilliant, you know, and try and be inclusive and absolutely come along. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful thing. But if it's just a little bit of a mindless, no thought to it, let's throw them up there and see what happens kind of a thing, it can be a little frustrating to the evening, because ultimately you're selling the tickets and you care about the people you're selling the tickets to, right?
Exactly. That's why, yeah, I like the acoustic thing so much, when people come in and, you know, that's awesome, because it's cool. People dig it, you know, and it's easy on the ears, and then we can go out and just throttle them into submission.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Amazing. Yeah.
But it's interesting, you know, I don't know about you, but I find that what's been refreshing, like forever, because I was able to go over to Europe and actually just tour, I always thought, well, you know, people would say, well, Europe's better, right? And I'm like, well, you know, there's just an infrastructure over there. There's venues where, you know, it's about the music. They have decent PAs. They put you up as part of the deal. They feed you as part of the deal. And so, you know, you can play every night of the week. And after, you know, 3 weeks, you're tired as shit, but you've made money and you've seen some awesome sights, and, you know, it's been great, you know, whereas in the States, it's like, you know, a lot of times, you know, your first time into an area, it's a door deal. There's nothing provided. And so you're like, man, it's kind of a drag. But then you start touring in the States and you realize, oh, well, if you draw X amount of people and if the deal's good, you can actually make dough. And 9 times out of 10, the sound man doesn't say shit to you about your volume. You go in there, people are only there to see you. And you can, but in Europe, you fart and you got Hans up in your face saying, this is too loud. Can you turn it down? Can we put a panel on your buttocks? It is too loud. I hear the sound. And you're like, listen, you know, it's not about us curtailing everything that we do to fit into your room. It's like, if you know what we do, we're not a polka band. We're not a easy.
Didn't you write a song about this? Don't you have a German themed song?
I think I do. I did something online at some point where I bemoaned this whole thing. Günther's Fury, I believe it's called.
That was it. Absolutely magic. It's totally true. I do have a slight aversion. I call them sneeze guards. The little plastic, oh, yes,
exactly. Yep.
Gate in front. I just find that looks so strange, especially if you get one and you surround the whole drummer with it.
Right.
And it just looks like they're in a fish tank.
Yes.
I have trouble with that. I have trouble with that. But yeah, I think, I mean, volume-wise, if you're playing this kind of music, there should be a degree of assertiveness to, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, you can... I remember going to see... the Allman Brothers Band and the Doobie Brothers had a double bill at the Greek in Los Angeles. And I was so excited. This is amazing. And the music was astounding. But you could hear people talking from across the amphitheater because there's this mad decibel limit there.
Right.
And I'm thinking, I don't want that.
Right.
I want to feel the blood trickling down from my ears, you know.
Well, you want to be amongst it.
Absolutely. Got to be assertive.
And it's an interesting thing because folks, a lot of people these days, it would seem, I don't want to generalize too much, but there's a lot of folks that are like, well, what do you mean we want to talk? It's like, no, this isn't about talking. This is an immersive experience. Like when I go and see a band, I don't want to talk to the people next to me. I want to hear the band. In between songs, I might say, well, that was really cool, or this, that, the next thing. But I want to be amongst it. You know, I want to be immersed. And it's not about music being a soundtrack to your, I mean, certainly there are those situations, then go to those places where you want to have that experience, where bands are like a background thing, or, oh, I like this song, I think I'll dance. Hey, that's all well and good. But if you're going to go to a showcase where the band is doing their thing, and I mean, all the people that I was influenced by, they all played loud as shit. I mean, those walls of Marshalls were not playing. They were not, you know, they weren't props back then. That was my favorite thing is that a gentleman came out to Wildwood out in Colorado, and I was doing videos, and my buddy Steve, who owns the store, was like, hey, would you mind saying hi to this fella? And I'm like, sure, he's got a present for you. I'm like, oh, great. Guy came in, nice as pie. He lives out in Colorado now, but he originally lived in Toledo, and he had taken a picture of Hendrix playing in Toledo in 1968, and he blew it up and he gave it to me. It's this framed picture. Wow. And it's awesome because he's literally like in the third row, and you see Jimmy, Nolan, Mitch. And what's wild about it is I showed it to my son. I go, what do you notice about this picture? He's like, there's no mic on the drums. I go, that is correct. So it's two walls of Marshalls for Jimmy, a wall of Sun for Noel, and Mitch is just pounding the drums.
Oh my God.
And you know, a lot of times back then there was no PA. I mean, other than the vocal PA. I mean, I remember hearing stories, and again, you don't know how much is urban myth and what's true or not, but I've had people who are like, yeah, I saw Cream at Madison Square Garden, and they lowered the boxing mic to the stage, and that's how you heard it throughout the place. Just the stage volume. So that was their way to be heard. So, but I would imagine if you're close to the, and Frank Zappa told the story about how, you know, when he played that house gig at the Garrick Theater, up, it was upstairs from the Cafe Wa, and Hendrix, when he first came back over from England with the experience, they played the Cafe Wa, and Frank came down to see him. But he said there were so many people there that he kind of got sandwiched in this area that was right in front of Jimmy, and he couldn't move. And they started, he goes, it was so unbelievably loud because I had no idea how anyone could inflict it upon themselves other than somebody else. But, you know, that's the way it was back then. It's like you didn't go up to Hendrix and say, hey, can you turn that down? I mean, maybe some people did. And he said, yeah, that's not happening.
I remember getting told to turn down once before I'd even gotten my amp out the van. We pulled up to a venue and it was, hey, nice to meet you, sound engineer. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Hey, should we start loading in? He goes, yeah. You know, this room, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty lively. You want to watch your stage volume. And I looked at him and I went, mate, can you hear anything?
Right.
It's still in the van. It's still in its case.
Right.
Before you pass judgment, can we set up? And right, then we can talk about it, maybe.
But, you know, it's interesting to that point. I mean, it's like, you know what bands are going to do, so treat your room accordingly. I don't know if you ever played that little place outside of New York City, that the Turning Point in
Piedmont. Yeah, I have played.
I love that place. And great. I first walked into that place and I'm looking around like, oh my God, we are going to annihilate people in this room. But it's a room that can take it. There are rooms that are built that are these funky rooms that are built for music, and they can take it, as opposed to, oh, I think we'll have bands and they'll have no treatment whatsoever anywhere, and then they're looking at you like, can you guys turn down? It's like, well, thanks for putting me in a place where, again, a well-placed fart will be deafening.
Absolutely.
So and
there is sometimes you get the engineers that are more often than not wonderful, fabulous, brilliant, we understand what you're doing, and then you get the you're in my house now kind of engineer that is like, you know, suddenly you'll be playing and you hear front of house and he's got like this mad phasing delay going on, you know, and halfway through one of your songs, you're totally inappropriate. You've never heard of us before. You've never heard our music. What the fuck are you doing? It can be, yeah, you're at the mercy a little bit until you travel with your own, I guess. But
exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did this weird gig in San Diego, and we had a bunch of different West Coast things, and my agent's like, listen, it's a Wednesday night, I got it open, but there's this place that's adjacent to apparently the Musicians Union Hall, that's like a jazz room of a sort, but you can rent it out, and and it, at least it's a gig. And if people show up, you make money. If you don't, you don't. And I'm like, okay, well, I'd rather play than not. Right.
Yeah.
So we got there and we had to wait for the yoga class to get over with before we could go in. And we went in and there was a slight smell of butt foot in the air, you know, as exercise spaces will sometimes manifest. But, you know, it had this nice stage and cool, like giant kind of prints of, you know, Wes Montgomery and Charlie Parker. Like, oh, this is kind of a vibey little joint. So we get in there and we set up our stuff and they literally just have a vocal PA. We're like, okay, well, it's no problem. And people are like, you guys sounded unbelievably good in here. It's like, that's because we know how to mix ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of these guys don't understand. Guys and gals, whatever you want to say. Sound reinforcement professionals, of which most are great. But what a lot don't understand is that when you have a band that knows how to play and knows how to mix themselves, just do the minimal and add just what needs to be added.
Yes. And then leave it alone.
Exactly.
Yeah, don't fuss with it. Come, you know, doing all of this.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But that, I think that's also just, you know, good musicians, right? They know how to blend, make the stage sound good.
Right.
And that's, yeah.
You'd like to hope that's the case.
Yeah. Easy said and done, right?
So what are some of your favorite places to play? Do you have like a... Do you have like a set schedule of the year of like, well, at this time of year, I usually go out west and this time of year I do this, or is it just changes from year to year, depending on what's happening?
It just changes really. I mean, we do a lot of our work kind of at the East Coast. And I think just it's easier to tour the East Coast, right?
Right. There's a ton of humans there.
There are a ton of humans there. Yeah. It's just easier travel. No, it's just kind of, year to year, really. I mean, as far as favorite venues, we just got back from a little run that was fabulous. We did the Acorn Theater in Three Oaks, Michigan, which is certainly an hour and a half or so from here. And it's beautiful, small theater, arts council kind of... Oh, it's fabulous and lovely people. And we had a great night. And then... Fort Wayne, Indiana, we played there at the Baker Street Center. That's always a fun gig. And then a new venue for us out in near Detroit called the Roxy in Rochester.
Oh, I haven't been there.
Oh, do you remember Callahan's out in Auburn Hills?
I do remember. I played there once, yep.
Yeah, that was a great kind of funky, just the right amount of your feet stick to the floor kind of a place. And this is a brand spanking new venue, and we had a great night there. So,
excellent.
We did really well there, but I don't know. The Iridium in New York is always
That's a fun one, right?
Oh, always a joy. Yeah, and Sellersville Theatre is beautiful. God, there are some fabulous venues out there. Really are.
Yeah, that's good times. It's good times to go out and just rock people's brains. I always have a good time. It's like
Good Lord, yeah. Why would you ever complain about it? What a privilege it is to get to do it.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about some guitar geekery. So you're a Telesman. You're not afraid of the power of the Telecaster.
No, it's my favorite. That's what I grew up playing, really. And so my first real electric guitar was a Mexican-made Telecaster that I still have and still use. And it's a great guitar. I remember my dad, he was a folky and played acoustic, and he knew nothing about electric guitars. I remember when I was 11 or 12, first getting into it, I said, "Dad, what's the best electric guitar in the world?" And he said, "Well, son, there are two, but they're both rare as hen's teeth. You'll never get, you know, they're really expensive, really rare." Totally talking out of his ass. It's the Fender Stratocaster, but the best one is the Telecaster. Said, but they only made a few of them a long time ago. Not realizing that they pump out, you know, millions of them a day.
Right.
You know? And so that always stuck with me, that the Telecaster was kind of this.
Yeah, the Holy Grail.
Yeah. And so I played Telecasters for forever, got that Mexican made one and loved it. And then, went into Strats for a bit. I just kind of naturally gravitated towards Fender. And then He passed away about nine years ago this year. And after he'd gone, I saw this old one in a shop near me here in Chicago. And I thought, that's just about affordable as far as these things go. Everything that had been done to it had been done from a player's aspect, you know, like to keep the whole thing ticking over. And I thought, well, maybe there's something to this. And I went and played it, and I was just, that's it for me. And it's a 66.
Aha, the year of my birth.
All right, yeah. So 66 Telecaster, it's been refinished. There's pickups in and out and refretted. But it was kind of like after I'd lost my dad, it was just kind of like, look, Dad, I got a real one, you know?
Right.
You know, it was this kind of moment. And I haven't been able to put that down. That's been my main guitar now for 8-9 years.
And how are the, are there the original pickups in there? Do you find that they,
I actually got rid of the original. I've tried to be really practical with my gear. I had the original bridge pickup in it, and I thought it was rubbish. I didn't like it at all. So I found someone who wanted it for a project, and they had it, and they got it. I sold that. And I've got these pickups that Joel Wilkins, JW Guitar Restoration, he made those pickups for me, and magic.
Excellent.
Absolutely magic. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've got this beast. For years and years and years, I wanted a... you know, a blackguard, as they say. And of course they're unobtainium because they're so freaking expensive. So this one came in Wildwood, and I remember playing it, and it had the little frets, and I'm like, and it's a spray over. So it's not as expensive as it would be if it was all ridge. And there's like a little hole under here. That's, I don't even know why someone did that, but there's a little hole in it, but it's the original electronics.
Yeah,
I think it's been refretted, but they're smaller frets.
Right.
And it's the most amazing sounding guitar clean, but if I add any gain at all, it howls like a pig.
Sure.
So I use it for clean stuff, you know, if I'm in the studio, and I keep it at home because I love it. And I'm kind of the mindset of, well, it just kind of is what it is. You know, I've thought about maybe having the pickups rewound, but, you know, I have my Reverends with my signature pickups in it that are kind of that's more of like the battle axe. It's
completely, yeah,
sussed and ready for battle. Whereas this is just kind of an art piece. You know what I mean? As much as I play it all the time.
Yeah, and almost, you know, the dream manifest, right? That this is, you've finally gotten it.
And what the thing is that the neck pickup is so wimpy, but God, it sounds so good. And it's really the most howly. If I add any gain to it at all, it just, while it's green, it's so gorgeous. I just don't want to mess with it. So it's just one of those things where, again,
beautiful, beautiful,
an art piece per se, and kind of a guilty pleasure, as it were. I did.
Oh no!
I got rid of a lot of stuff to get it. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of like the only old thing I have in terms of guitars. I've got like a 74 Strat that I got a couple years ago, which is not something I would have gravitated to, but it was in the midst of COVID-19, and things were kind of waning a little bit, and you could kind of go out in public and stores were open again. And it was kind of, Father's Day and my birthday are like days apart. So my wife used the term, you need some self-care. Why don't you go out to the guitar shop? Excuse me, can I get this written down? So I went out to the shop, and I remember I saw the big headstock Strat. Now, I've always just had an affinity for big headstock Strat because of Hendrix.
And
of, you know,
Blackmore.
Robin Trower and, you know, all our 70s buddies. And I kind of looked up, and I was like, what is that? And I said to the guy, what is the deal with the Strat? And he goes, oh, it's a 74. And I remember I reached up, because I was tall enough, I was able to grab it. And I picked it up with one hand. I was like, oh my God, this weighs nothing. I go, what is the deal with this thing? And the guy's like, well, it's a single owner, guy from Texas. It's immaculate. And I go, this must weigh like maybe 7.5 pounds. Like, yeah, it's totally weird. And it still had the three-way toggle switch in it, which I've kept. And man, it's just a delight. It's just so weird how you play differently on smaller frets, because that's the guitar. I mean, my Telly origin story was, and I don't know if it's the same for you, if you were, it was not that the people I was listening to, although there were some that were the Telly guys. It wasn't like, I need a Telly because these guys played it. It was the Fender guitar that was available to me, you know?
Right.
And then when I got it, it's just like, ergonomically speaking, I was like, oh my God, this does everything I needed to do. It's like, you know, and I really had that thing where like, well, neck pickup is kind of how I build things. You know, middle pickup's kind of my rhythm thing. And then when I go for the jugular, I go to the back and that's kind of my lead sound. It's like, it's all done.
Yeah.
And, but I always wanted a Strat. And then when I got a Strat, it sounded weird to me because I was used to kind of that wimpier neck pickup and the ballsier bridge pickup.
Sure. And, I always found there was, with a Strat, I mean, all of my heroes were Strat players, really, you know, but, I found like, well, that Mark Knopfler kind of in-between sound, the two pickup sound, I absolutely adore it. I love it. But that's his. As soon as I was playing that, I was going, well, that's his sound. That's his. I don't feel like I've got any of me in this. I couldn't do that. And then I always hit the middle pickup. I always found that I would, you know, graze the middle pickup with the pick constantly.
Oh, there you go. Yep.
I'm not very good with wobble sticks. With kind of, I love people who can do it, but for me, I always
Mr. Wiggles, always as I like to call it.
It always sounds like a nervous twitch to me when I do it. You know,
I hear you.
And then too many knobs. I like futzing. There's all the. I just want one to make it off or on.
Right.
And the one to make it dark or bright. And that's it. Any more than that, and I'm going to get confused, you know. So the Telecaster for me is just, it's just very, very practical. Yeah, everything is totally. Right there. I know where everything is. Exactly. Nothing gets in the way.
And you can rock like a bitch on it. You can play. It sounds great clean. It's good for picking. It's good for anything. There was a point where I forced myself to play Strat, and then that was like my main guitar for, you know, probably a good decade. Although I always had a Telly and I always had some kind of, you know, either 335, Les Paul, SG, something like that. And then at one point I just said, you know what? I'm tired of dealing with just the tuning issues on a Strat. You know, and I'm not Captain Handsy when it comes to working on my stuff. You know what I mean? I've always had somebody set my guitars up for me. And it's like with Strats, I always felt you kind of had to have that MacGyver thing. You know what I mean? You're always, because I like Mr. Wiggles. I don't, you know, I like to be able to do certain things with it. I like a floating bridge so I can just palm it and add a little vibrato here and there. And
oh, yeah.
But I find that, you know, all of a sudden the guitar, you know, the seasons change or whatever. And next thing you know, you can't get it to stay in tune for love nor gold. Mm-hmm. And so then I just like force myself. I'm going back to a Telly regardless, you know. And then you always feel when you go back to the Telly or with a guitar without all that stuff, you're like, well, now I've just like completely eschewed this entire trick bag of all this extra sonic arsenal that I have at my disposal. And I'm like, yeah, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to do this for a long period of time. And then I would have a Strat, but Strats in comparison to Tellys just sound intrinsically wimpier. You know what I mean?
It's not for me. I don't know. I felt like my whole kind of mission, if you like, my little kind of ego mission throughout all of the... since day one, really, was I would like to be able to pick up a guitar and sound like me. I have all of these heroes, but what I recognize in them and what I love about them is that they're all so distinct.
Right.
And I felt like I could never do that with a Strat. It was always going to be me, you know, attempting to emulate someone else. Whereas with a Telecaster, I felt just so comfortable with this sounds and feels like me. I can achieve everything I want on it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Perfectly said. Because it's more of a blank canvas.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. You can hit the bugger.
Whereas the Strat's more of like you're coloring in. It's more of a coloring book.
paint by numbers. No.
Although that being said, I do have another guitar coming out with our friends at Reverend. It's kind of on the hush hush, but maybe by the time this, it'll probably. And I also worked on some pickups with Fishman that are more like S-like, shall we say, but really dealt with all the things that bothered me about Strats over the years. So I think I've rectified, at least for me personally, the things that always, not bemoaned using a Strat, but just were always trigger points, shall we say. So it'll be kind of fun to have that out again, because I'm just such a huge Hendrix fan, and I just, I still listen to bootlegs at night, especially now that it seems like Janie Hendrix and the Hendrix Experience Hendrix crew have been a little lenient on people posting various different live things now, because they'd be all over it and take it down, and now they're everywhere. You can hear all kinds of different stuff, and hearing that guy from night to night, it can just be like, Jimmy's not into it tonight, and then I was like, oh, Jimmy's into it tonight, and then you just hear this the most amazing shit.
Yeah,
and that's what I just love about that whole era of just so cowboy, showing up. Again, just with the whole uncertainty of the PA and the setup. And, a lot of times you see pictures of him going through the crowd, with his fuzz face and his wah with a guitar and the other guys holding the other, and they just put stuff against the amp. There's no roadies per se. I mean, in terms of like guitar,
just someone holding the amplifier at the back.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And then it's like, sorry, folks, we need a minute here to tune up. It's like, you couldn't have done that before you hit the stage.
Again, Rory was the same way for me. Just kind of like, battered AC30, yep. Strat leaning up against it. It's up on a chair.
Yes.
And then playing the Royal Albert Hall like that.
Right.
And I think that's fabulous.
Totally.
Fabulous. Yeah.
It was all just genuine, like flying by the seat of your pants. And then of course all the money got involved, and then it became, not that money always hasn't been involved. Obviously these guys wouldn't be out doing something if somebody wasn't making money. But it just seemed to be a lot more about the art, as it were, more so. I mean, again, there's always commercial things at play, but then it became totally about commodification as far as the bigger show, and making sure that there's no uncertainty. I mean, I remember the first time I went out on any kind of a tour and we were opening up for somebody, and I saw all these printed out things catering this way and this, that. I was like, this is about as anti-rock and roll as you get. I want to see chicken scratch, someone just writing with a Sharpie, and then set lists would always be, printed out and everything. Oh, switch guitar here. It's like, I don't like set lists. I go out and it's going to be, there might be some similar things from night to night, but I call the shit as I go, because that's the way it should be.
Well, also it's a great, you read the audience. Hey, this is where I think the evening should go. And every audience is different. Every night is different. You should be able to adjust to that.
Exactly.
I'm with you. Oh, 100%. Yeah. Just again, it's this kind of, attitude I didn't get to see shows in that era, but much of what I adore and much of what has influenced me is from that era. And this idea of, it's not about any of this stuff. It's not about this prestigious room that we're in. Fuck all of that. It's about me. Look at what I can do. And it's about the attitude of going out and doing it. And I think that's what made it so effective.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Hendrix's last gig was at that Fehrmann Festival in Germany, which there was some talk about we might do. There's going to be an anniversary thing coming up, which I'm hoping happens. But anyway, my favorite thing is that there was, there was a bunch of inclement weather and people were grumpy as shit. And by the time Hendrix hit the stage, it was way late or, delayed or whatever. And there was a bunch of like weird, troubled people in the crowd that were protesting this, that, and the next thing. So when he gets on stage, they're all booing. And he just goes up, and he could have cared less. He comes up there looking resplendent in, you know, whatever garb he had, you know. He comes out and he goes, "I don't give a fuck if you boo as long as you boo in key." And I thought, and it was just like, and he's like, "Boo, boo." He's like, "I don't give a fuck if you boo as long as you boo in key." He goes, "I'm going to need to tune up here. I'll be right with you." And it was just like, this is the coolest guy on the planet. And then he was too cool. And then he had to go over to some other realm of existence.
Yeah. Wow, man. A guy that lived in the village I grew up in, one of my dad's friends, when I started getting into guitar, he said, I went to the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970. And I'm like, no way, amazing, you know, wow. So you saw Hendrix. He goes, well, he said, I traveled the length and breadth of Britain to get down to the Isle of Wight. He's right. From Northern Ireland. He said, I got down to the Isle of Wight, said, I took far too many drugs. Fell asleep in the tent and woke up just as he was ending. Oh, God. Nightmare.
Well, that was not one of Jimmy's better outings, although there were moments. But what's interesting is that he went right from there. It's like 24 hours later, he was playing, I think, in Sweden. So his schedule was just brutal. And of the tour in 1970 of Europe right before he died, there were some gigs that were really rough, but there were other gigs where, man, I mean, he still had it. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. It's just that they were just so ground down. And
when you were talking earlier about, accessibility and generations coming back, it took me a long time to get into Hendrix. It wasn't an immediate thing for me. I was listening to Martin Offler. It's very neat, very precise, and very, right. Melodic, thought out. Not saying Hendrix isn't melodic by any stretch, but very, very tidy. And when I first heard Hendrix, I thought, shit's really messy. This is, all over the place. And, right. And wow, where is he going with this? Right. And it took me a while. And it, obviously once it clicked, it was like astounding. But
well, that's one of the things that I think that, younger folks probably don't realize, just because, I mean, Hendrix was a total perfectionist. So anything that saw the light of day while he was alive was pristine. And the whole thing of him playing gigs and it was that he was all into exploration, but he was also very protective of anything he put out. That's why it's so funny. He talks about Band of Gypsies, like, yeah, it wasn't the greatest. And there's some stuff that's out of tune. And we listen to Band of Gypsies and we're like, I mean, yeah, you can hear little things here and there, but for the most part, it's fucking awesome. But if you listen to those concerts in their totality, there's some squirrely shit going on. But Jimmy knew to edit all that stuff out so that the product that got out for common consumption was, perfecto. And then, he dies and people are making money. And of course, I am a fan of whatever I can hear for Jimmy. So I don't mind hearing all the stuff, wrinkles and all. But I think for a lot of folks, they might hear something like, oh, you got to hear this Hendrix thing. And then it's like Jimmy on a not a good night where tempos are fluctuating and intonation is speculative. And, it becomes harder to contextualize. And then also, I think a huge thing about it, too, is that people, of course, have now heard dive bombs and fuzz craziness. And
Right. And they forget.
It had never been done.
Yeah.
When people listen to that stuff for the first time are like, oh, my God, what is going on here? This is insanity.
Yeah, context to the time it was made, for sure.
Well, listen, I think we're running out of time here. I know my Zoom is going to come to a screeching halt here for a minute, but thanks so much for taking time. It was an absolute pleasure talking with you, Davey. It's good to see you again. It's been a while.
And you, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, and I'll let you know when this comes out. And on Thursdays, they usually debut them, but we've got a few in the queue. I try to get as many done before I have to hit the road again, so I'll keep you apprised.
Sounds good.
All right, my friend. Have a good one. Take it easy.
Take care. Bye now.
See you later. Folks, thanks so much for tuning in. We certainly do appreciate you stopping by and partaking in the most savory, chewable gristle this side of Cucamonga. Gregory Cawk, looking forward to seeing you again next week, even though I won't actually see you, but I'll sense your presence.